So Misty's still off at CIA training. Yeah. And learning about lying and everything. And, you know, we speak every night, but I actually got a letter from Rashi. And he's also undergoing CIA training.
Are they, like, interrogating him, or is he actually getting the training?
Well, the letter says, Dad, blew shit up. Awesome! Rashi. And, you know, Rashi is misspelled with, like, three H's in the middle of it. I don't know. I guess his Black Ops training is going even better than expected.
We'll see him on the 9 o'clock news anytime now.
Yeah, probably driving a tank away from the news cameras. It has happened before. Hey, welcome to another installment of Almost Live with Paul and Misty, with no Misty. Misty is still off in the wilds of Northern California on her training mission. We will be checking in with her next week. She'll be back. And so this is just me, Paul Dini, batching it with Ezra and Emily here. And of course, Deuce and Muggsy. And we're back for our second week with our special guest, my good pal, Alan Burnett.
It feels like we just did this a couple minutes ago.
Isn't it remarkable? The way a week flies like nothing. I don't think anybody knows. How did we meet?
Actually, I met your office before I met you.
Because I was not showing up at Warner Brothers.
You were on a vacation, and they didn't have an office for me, so they gave me your office, which was a mess, by the way.
Nothing changed.
I tried not to move anything because you know this is the desk of Paul Dini.
Piles of crap.
But you worked at. I swear I saw you in the hallway at Hanna-Barbera in the mid-80s.
I was, you know, because I would go in there and pitch stuff, you know, like I would pitch on shows.
You were Smurfs, too, weren't
Smurfs, you know, I would go in and who was the gentleman who was the story editor on Smurfs? I remember he had kind of like white...
Ted Anasty or no. Gerard Baldwin?
No, I remember he had white hair and a beard, and if that sounds familiar. But he was a guy I was pitching to. He was like, he was one of the story editors. Don't recall. I just remember I wrote a couple of Smurfs for him, and I remember there was like a Meet Peo meeting way back when Peo came in and talked about a whole season's worth of Smurfs, and you saw this guy who was like a more ragged version of both Jim Henson and Gallagher, or the magician, and Doug Henning, talking to everybody. And no, the Smurf do this and they do that.
Oh,
and
I know what you're talking
don't
about.
Don't do that. That was Peo. He came in and had this big meeting.
Oh, he also had a partner who talked like that.
Oh, okay.
You know, by the way, I don't know if you got it, but the Writers Guild
sent
out lists of Smurf lists of all the episodes, trying to find out who wrote all of them.
I did. Well, is there money involved?
Not anymore. I've taken all credit.
Oh, yes, okay.
I guess down the line there is, because you know, in Europe we get a little bit. The writers get a little bit of the money.
Yeah,
it ends up in the Writers Guild to spread it around. So they're trying to find out who wrote all the Smurfs.
I wrote all 19 years of Smurfs myself.
There were 10 years.
10 years. 10 years. That was like a real shot in the arm for Hanna-Barbera. I mean, that was like their prize show for a long time.
It was the big blue wall.
Yeah.
Nobody could climb over it. The other networks could not beat it.
Wow.
And it was 90 minutes for, I think, 9 of those years.
Wow.
And the first year was an hour. So it was really an amazing... kids just latched onto it for a decade.
I knew about the Smurfs years before because my French teacher in high school brought in comic books for us to read. So like Schrumpfs, you know, he'd bring it in the original French. And... Asterix and stuff like that, Tintin. And he would bring in, you know, like comic albums and they would be written in French. And I would go like, French is easy. I can just follow the pictures. You know, these little elves are building a rocket ship and out of wood. And they get one drunk and they think he's on another planet. He thinks he's on another planet. This is really good. Oh, French is easy. Oh, here they beat up the minstrel again and the Romans. Oh, yeah. And then I tried reading some French without pictures. And it's like, what? Where are the little blue guys? But that was fun. So when the Smurfs finally got on TV, I was going like, oh, this will be like those funny graphic novels. And they were and they weren't, because I remember the graphic novels, they were a little funnier. They were a little, they had a loopier quality to them. And I think on TV, they
did. Yeah, it's TV, you know, 6 to 11. Well, they're actually 2 to 11 year olds.
Yeah.
That's the audience we're expected to get. Well, they're coming back. We'll see if they live again.
I don't know. Did you see the trailer for the new movie?
Has it changed?
Well, it's like them running around. It's like Home Alone, Lost in New York. You know?
Yeah, all I've seen is the one of them hanging on the cab.
Yeah, that's all I've seen.
Yeah.
Hank Azaria yelling at Gargamel. At Azrael, going like, "All right, now you're milking it." You know, he's doing his Paul Winchell.
I didn't know that he was. I didn't know that was him.
Hank Azaria.
Yeah. He's doing that part.
Yeah,
he's great for that part.
Yeah.
Now I'm interested.
Yeah.
So there we go.
I miss Paul Winchell though. Doing his Dick Dastardly snicker as you worked with him, right?
Well, yeah, I was in the room as the recording was happening.
Who was the best voice artist you ever worked with? Now, did you ever work with Mel Blanc?
No, never did.
Dawes?
No.
Huh?
I was at the start of a new generation of Hanna-Barbera product, I think. There were a bunch of new writers that came in when I came in.
Right.
And they needed all the writers they could get.
Well, yeah, they were doing show after show at that time over at HB. I never worked there steadily. I would occasionally go in based on who I knew with story editing. Like Tom Ruger was doing Scooby-Doo's. Like he would have an idea for a Scooby-Doo or a premise. Or he wrote an outline for a Halloween one where they meet some real monsters. And he said, "Do you want to write the script?" And it's like, okay. So I came in and would take a scripting assignment from him and stuff like that.
Yeah, there were a whole bunch of older writers who were sort of on their way out, I guess, when I got there. And a lot, you know, there were three martini lunches.
Oh, yeah.
I understood why sentences ended in, you know, 5 exclamation marks at that place, because I couldn't keep up with them. You give me 3 martinis and I'm no good for the rest of the afternoon.
You'll be screaming Mises to pieces,
Mises
too.
To pieces. These guys kept writing, and more power to them.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I never worked there steadily, but one of the things I really enjoyed about Warner Brothers is after they incorporated with Hanna-Barbera, Bill and Joe came over, and I remember there were a few occasions when you and I would go out to lunch with Joe Barbera and just hear old stories from him.
Right.
And I think that was, like, the best part of the experience was I didn't have to work with Joe and take, you know, notes on anything, but I got to hear fun stories with him. And so thank you for including me in those lunches. Oh, that was a lot of fun.
He enjoyed everybody, you know. He was a very pleasant fellow.
I remember this one time, like, I brought a copy of his autobiography that he had written, and I just thought, you know, God, I can't ask this because the guy's probably 108 years old and he's probably hasn't picked up a pencil in years. But I brought it for him to sign. I said, "Do you feel like drawing something today?" And he goes, "What, you know, drawing in your book?" And he goes, "Yeah, just a little sketch, you know, I don't know. Fred Flintstone, you know, any sort of little doodle." He goes, "Mm-hmm." And he sat down and he drew a flawless Tom and Jerry. And I mean, as good as anything he did in the 40s.
Wow.
And the characters had the personality. It was Tom leaning down with that little, the pouty jaw, and Jerry kind of waving up at him. He always had it.
You still have this?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's in the book. He took 2 pages and drew it.
You have to show me sometime.
If I find it, I think he, because he drew all that himself, he and Bill, you know, drew a lot of that himself. I think that stuff he always had a flavor for. I think there was a lot of middle stuff, you know, that, you know, was delegated to other people, that if you asked him for Top Cat, I don't know if he probably could, but, you know, there was something about the way he drew Tom and Jerry that he never lost. And always had that sense of animation to him. And I think he knew how good those cartoons were, because at one point we were at lunch and I said, "You know, there was one cartoon that really upset me as a kid that you did." And he goes, "Oh, I know. Pauvre, pauvre pussycat. Tom gets his head cut off in the guillotine. Yeah, I know. Everybody hates that one." I said, "Well, I don't hate it. It just upset me." "Yeah, I know. We just wanted to make an epic, you know, so he gets his head cut off in the guillotine. Yeah, yeah. Every kid has nightmares over that."
They were great fellows, both of them.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I actually put it out on Twitter if there were questions from fans about some of the work that you and I have done together. And do you want to see if there's anything and anything you want to talk about as far as our...
Why not? By the way, is Tower Prep coming back?
Tower Prep? What is that, anyway? Oh, you know, they sound... Oh, well, that's one of the things here. It says, on Wikipedia, it says Tower Prep has been canceled. It's like, yeah, Wikipedia.
Yeah.
That's a great source.
Yeah. And also, the African elephant is extinct now.
The what?
The African elephant. That Stephen Colbert did that thing where he couldn't make the African elephant extinct on Wikipedia.
Oh, yeah.
He changed it.
Well, there's also that thing on Wikipedia that was blaming Godzilla for Japan.
That was awesome.
Yeah.
Well. That's how much you can trust Wikipedia.
Yes. Tower Prep. When's Tower Prep coming back? I know you're tired of the same message. Tower Prep, Tower Prep.
Wow.
I would drop pianos from windows for a Radio Rashi t-shirt. Okay, well,
that's... Oh, nice.
Okay, well, we'll get to work on that.
I want to see the piano drop first.
Yeah. Well, this is from... Well, we should run our questions from the fans' music.
Okay.
Questions from the fans.
Okay, now we've done that. So the intro to our questions part.
It was beautiful.
Yes, it was. It's very moving. What's it like knowing you created the most brilliant animated series of all time? Well, when I came up with the idea for The Simpsons. Batman I speak of.
It was started before, when I got there. I got on script number 7 or something like that. I don't know what that's like.
It's sort of, it had a rocky beginning.
Yeah.
And it had kind of like a kind of diffused vision as far as the storytelling went early on. And then, but it had those great illustrations by Bruce and Eric Radomski.
Right.
I think when you came in, you were sort of like the galvanizing force that straightened out the show. And
well, I had the good sense to forget all the rules I ever learned about Saturday morning TV. Well, it was an afternoon show.
So yeah,
We kept pushing the envelope, so that was good.
Boyd said to me a couple times that you guys were allowed to do things that no other Saturday morning or anything cartoon show was allowed to get away with, and that was the freeing part of it.
Yeah, it was under children's programs, but they wanted something that was going to catch everybody's attention, I think.
Yeah, God bless Margaret Lesh.
She
was in charge of Fox Kids and bought the show.
Yeah.
But
I don't think the people at Fox above her knew what they were going to get.
I don't think the folks at Warner Brothers who were doing the Batman movies really paid much attention to us either, and which was probably a blessing, because I know a little bit with the second movie, they wanted some of the designs used for some of the characters.
Well, the Penguin.
The Penguin and Catwoman a little bit. And DC Comics was, I remember early on that Bruce and I went to New York and had a meeting with DC Comics early on. They were happy that we were doing the show, but they also were concerned, like, well, you guys aren't going to screw it up, are you? And I was like, well, we'll try not to.
We'll try not to.
But I remember walking around New York with Bruce and his wife, Marta, and we were just looking at Art Deco everywhere and saying, it would be great if we could bring in, a touch of this, classic look to the backgrounds. And I remember we went up to the top of the Empire State Building one night and looked down at the city. And, the lights coming through the haze made it look all amber and, another place, another time. And I think a little bit of that went into some of the thinking. I just think it was a combination of the right people at the right time and, the right project.
Yeah.
And everybody, the chains were off. Like you said, it wasn't a Saturday morning show. So everybody had a little bit more to bring to it. And, not just the writers or the artists, but, of course the voice people, the musicians, even the assistants who worked on the show with us, it was kind of infectious. When you're working on a show that everybody loves, I think everybody works a little harder, everybody feels a little bit better, and they all want to be, part of it. And they all just bring their A game to it.
Hey, the fact that we could have guns and bullets and fist fights, that was like, was like nirvana. It was just the best.
Yeah, I mean, that was always so fun for me, is like the Joker could really set out to kill somebody. He never really would do it, or Batman would stop him, but his intent was always, deadly mayhem. And that made him a...
There's always stakes.
Have
stakes.
Yeah, you gotta have stakes. Two-Face, was a great character. He's very, a lot of pathos in that character, that two-part story, man. It was one of our best.
Well, there was a lady, Avery Coburn, who was our BS&P person, and she sort of knew what we were going after, and she helped us.
Yeah.
It was a very good relationship.
This is an interesting one. What do you think was the weakest element, biggest flaw of any of the shows you worked on?
Well, I'll tell you. I was at Hanna-Barbera for 6.5 years, and I left because I wasn't even bothering to look at the product that I wrote, because I just wanted better animation. So I went and got it elsewhere.
It was, I think we've talked about this before, it was sort of, we talked about this on the panel in San Francisco, starting off loving Hanna-Barbera when you're a kid, because the stuff was fresh and new, like the Flintstones and Huckleberry Hound and all that, and then the longer they became, the more they stayed a factory, the more it was just about keeping their doors open. It became like, how many shows can we sell? Oh, Filmation is selling 3 shows this year. We have to sell 6. That sort of thing.
They sold 13 half hours the first year I was there. That was 81.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all on Saturday morning.
Do you remember that story that Margaret told at Mr. Barbera's memorial? about the three shows he was pitching NBC.
Yeah.
I think Margaret was telling the story that she was working with Joe, and this was like sometime in the late 70s, and they were going into NBC, and they had three can't fail ideas that Joe had put together. One was he got the rights to Casper the Friendly Ghost, so they were going to redo Casper the Friendly Ghost. And the other one was an idea about two cute girl cops, you know, kind of like a cute girl version of Chips. And the other one was some space show.
Uh-huh.
And so Joe goes in and, you know, does a song and dance and pitches these three shows. And a short time later, they come out and both Joe and Margaret are kind of stunned. And Joe goes to call Bill Hanna and tell him, you know, what happened. And Joe gets on the phone and goes, "Well, Bill, we sold them the show." And Bill goes, "Great, which one?" And Joe says, "All of them." "Well, you sold them three shows?" "No, they ran all three shows together into one." So it's Casper in outer space in the future with two girl cops.
Yes.
And that was a testament to Joe's ability as a salesman, that as soon as they didn't like one episode, he just meshed the others together. But on the other hand, that was probably one of the weirdest shows they ever did. But it's very telling because, you know, Bill listens to it and he goes, "Well, at least we don't have to lay anybody off over Christmas."
Yeah.
Which is what it came down to. These guys were, you know, from the Depression era, and the most important thing was, you know, how do we keep our people working?
Yeah.
But that, were you there for those shows? Those sort
not
of...
those. Those were right before me. I remember whatever show she was talking about, that was before me.
Mm. Let's see. What was your favorite Batman episode?
Oh my gosh, you know, Heart of Ice. There was a couple. Heart of Ice. Mm. And the Hitchcock one that Joe Lansdale did, which was our Vertigo in a way.
Oh, which one was that?
For Chance to Dream.
Oh yeah,
I said it's Vertigo because it ended up on top of
the tower where he's fighting himself.
That's one where he has trouble reading in the dream.
Right? Yes.
Yeah, that one is stuck in my head for so long. It's like you can't read in dreams.
Yeah. Well, I actually had read that.
Yeah.
Someplace. And when I think about my dreams, I can't really, you can only go so far in the letters.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, but then somehow a psychologist got his hands on the script and said, "This isn't true."
Well, you can't, I can read this? Dreams. It doesn't make much sense, but you know.
I think your brain superimposes, you know, whatever you want it to be. Yeah. And it thinks that's what the words are. I don't know if you can actually read, but.
Yeah, I think it's more like the. Your brain makes
up. I thought
like, you think you're reading.
Yeah, whatever the artist did, when the letters turn into some weird printing, it was. I thought that he's had that.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. He's had that, and it worked.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, I believe it.
Here's one from Excaliburps, who says, "You guys have any plans on relaunching Batman the Animated Series or a movie or something? Batman Fever is at a fever pitch. How I miss the animated series." Well, you know, you're never far away from it because you've got DVDs coming out all the time and everything.
It was, you know, it was for its time, and then onward and upward, you know.
Yeah, you're doing other things. You got the showcases, you got... Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
There are certain things you just can't put back together again, you know, and you know, we'd have to go back to that place, and you know, we'd have to get the same crew together again.
And a lot of people moved on.
Everybody's moved on.
Yeah, Kevin Conroy keeps fighting to get out of the Batman voice, it seems like.
We do talk though sometimes about a DVD that's like an extended Batman the Animated Series. We do talk about that.
Really?
Yeah.
That would be fun.
There's no plans for it right now, but we do talk about it.
You and I worked on a little something. Oh, I can't talk about that really.
Which thing is that?
For one of the DVDs?
Oh, yes, we cannot talk about it.
We cannot talk about that.
But we can talk about it at Comic-Con.
At Comic-Con. So there's a little bit of a hint that you can find out about Comic-Con, which is probably where...
Search them down there.
I can answer some of these Tower Prep questions.
You may even see it there.
What, Tower Prep?
At Comic-Con.
What the Tower...
What we're talking about.
Oh, now. Yeah. The,
mystery thing the mystery we cannot thing. Speak of.
Oh, the mystery... Oh, will you be able to show it? Will be able to see it?
I would hope so.
Well, that would be wonderful. Is Warner Brothers ever going to let you and Alan Burnett take a crack at a live-action DC movie or a TV series? Well, they did a while back. Actually, we developed a Batman Beyond live-action movie.
Boaz.
Boaz Yakin.
Brought us in.
Yeah.
And,
interesting.
But it was his baby.
Yeah.
And he really wanted to do something that was really pushed the envelope, so... And it didn't happen, and life goes on.
If you had your choice of any DC property to do as a to write and produce as a live action movie, or even direct, is there one that would come to mind? Is there one that you'd like to do more than any other?
I would like to see a version of Dead Man, but I always talk about that. I find Dead Man fascinating.
He is, definitely.
Yeah.
That the Wednesday Comics version of him was really beautiful.
Yeah, he's just a hard guy to contain. You'd have to change the rules a little bit because he's just a hard guy to contain. He gets into people. He gets out of them. Can he get into the same person again? I mean, he's very powerful. He really is very powerful. You know, and I'll tell you, the costume never. I think the costume is a hindrance to a live action show.
I think the costume is a hindrance to a lot of characters. You know, I mean, it certainly works for selling an action figure, but I mean, if I was going to do one, I would probably do Martian Manhunter, because I think that there's something very appealing about him, especially divorcing him from the Justice League and, you know, being one of the superheroes. What's fascinating to me is, like, somebody who can come to Earth and pass as a human, his natural form is repellent to human beings, so he has to try and blend in, but he's trying to warn people also that there are other aliens out there, you know, bad aliens, like the aliens who wiped out his people, and he's here to warn us. And I think that's a very compelling story.
Yeah.
But I could almost see them doing that with very little special effects and very little of his traditional powers. And then again, that kind of gets far away from Martian.
So you're
Manhunter.
Talking about toning down the his powers completely.
Yeah, I mean, I would not deal with him as a member of the Justice League or even as a superhero, and I wouldn't put him in the cape.
Because he's like a Swiss Army knife. He's got these disparate powers that don't really, you know, it's like, what powers does Superman not have? Let's give it to this guy.
But if you're doing Martian Manhunter, you'd almost, and you know, to just give a little credence to the Manhunter part of it, you make it like The Fugitive on Earth. There are evil Martians who are here among us. He's got to root them out, and he's got to go into a variety of disguises to find the head guy. And at the same time, he's got to keep from being locked up himself or shot.
So what powers would you keep of it? So like his chameleon powers?
I would keep his chameleon powers and his strength. Maybe some element of his flight, or, you know, I have to take him way down to make him believable, like, you know, so that he isn't just a duplicate of Superman.
Okay, that would make more sense.
I mean, it's like, you know, people always assume that I would do a Zatanna movie before I do anything else, and I probably wouldn't, because, again, you know, or else I'd find some other way of doing it, because her powers are too undefined and too awesome.
Yeah, they are awesome.
Well, I'm trying. I haven't really done this with much success in the comic, but I'm going to try and work it in the future. In that, her powers are awesome within a contained area. Like a magician is in command of their stage, and I think her powers are great within. If she's got close proximity to somebody who can hear her voice, or someone she can touch, or someone who she can make eye contact with, and I think that the farther they get away from her, the less her power is, and the more undefined it becomes.
Okay.
But again, you know, oddly enough, not my first choice to make into a movie, because...
Who else?
Martian Manhunter, you know, probably Zatanna would probably be about 3 or 4, but probably a character like, I like the Demon an awful lot.
Demon's good.
The Demon is great. I know the rights to Sandman have been tied up forever with various people, but part of me, you know, will like reread The Sandman, and it's like there's so much poetry in there, and there's so many great visual things, and the writing is so good. I look at that and I go, I'm in awe of that book. Probably every issue of The Sandman. And part
of
me
talking about the Neil Gaiman one.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Not the original Wesley Dodd.
Well, even that's pretty good, but you know, I just feel that there's so much
stuff.
The Sandman is so good. We actually talked about putting him in, doing an episode of the animated series, of having him, you know, having him bringing the Sandman into that world. And I remember Neil Gaiman was intrigued by the idea, and I think he would have said yes, but I don't think we ever cracked a story for that. It was sort of like Batman in the Dreamland between life and death or something like that. And the story never got beyond that, unfortunately. I mean, the fear of that is there are certain things that you like them in book form and you'd love to see a movie version of it. And then when you see it, it's like, oh, that was a bad idea. But there's something about Sandman that's just perfect as a comic book. But even the idea of putting that on screen is sort of, you know, it's very intriguing. But I think I want to see a good version of that done much more than I dare attempt to do one myself, you know. But Superman, I never can think of anything to do with them. Batman, you know, other people have done him better. I don't know. You know, it's hard. It's hard to say.
I mean, you know, if people are doing him. You and I, how many stories of them about them have we told?
Yeah.
You know?
So. Well, you know me, I'd strip it down to just the Joker. A Joker movie I would love to do. You know, just him on a spree, just going out and killing people. But there's no chance of that. Harley Quinn, I would never make a Harley Quinn movie because I just... Yeah, but people have approached me about that. Hey, I have an idea for a Harley Quinn movie, and if we get together, you know, and you take me into DC, I'll let you write it, and we can make a Harley Quinn movie. It's like, oh, so not interested. There's, I don't know, I would go for some, I'll tell you, Enemy Ace.
Enemy Ace?
Enemy Ace.
Okay.
That's a great character conflict, great time period, all the World War I fighting stuff and things like that. That'd be really good. I think something just a little bit off, out of the main track, I think you could get greater success with.
I've been very fascinated with Doom Patrol lately. And the Challengers of the Unknown, like those type of teams that we don't really see a lot of anymore.
Right,
you know, the people that are Doom Patrol, it's the freaks and the undesirables, and with Challengers of the Unknown, it's the people on the outskirts. And
I don't know. You're right. I think the lesser known to the mainstream character, the more of a chance that a really good writer and director, or you know, a guy doing both jobs, could reinvent the character slightly and make it appealing to a mainstream audience. And any character could work, you know, like Detective Chimp could work, you know, but it's just a matter of any idea could work. It just has to be a creation of personal vision, you know. And I think the Christopher Nolan movies are, you know, pretty much a creation of his vision and the people he works with. I think we got one more question, perhaps, and then we'll call it a night. How are you doing, Alan?
I'm fine.
All right. I would love to help you guys create an episode for Batman. That will be the greatest cartoon of all time. Okay. Great. All right. Is he going to work on a Tower Prep cartoon or web comic with you anytime soon? Big fan of the show. God, you know.
That's a Tower Prep cartoon.
Yeah. Tower Prep cartoon show. That's how we'll continue that. I don't know.
I got a random question for you. It's totally random. I saw that you've worked on GoBots in your time.
Oh, my God.
I was a bigger GoBots fan than Transformers, believe it or not.
Yeah.
Are you sad that there's nothing happening as far as GoBots movies to compete with the Transformers thing? No?
Not at all. they don't sell GoBots anymore, do they?
No, they don't. Yeah. No. I don't know why.
Well, you know. But I'll tell you something. GoBots, I worked on the first 5 GoBots.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the series was done by a fellow named Jeff Siegel. And so we did this 5-parter, which could be put together as a movie. I guess I don't know what.
Yeah, the Challenge of the GoBots.
But we went out to, this is when there was money in Saturday morning. We went out to New York for a big party celebrating the opening of GoBots. I guess, who made them? Who made GoBots? It was Tonka. Tonka. And Tonka had, I forget the name of the ship, but they had a battleship that they threw this party on in New York. And it was like being in a Woody Allen movie on a battleship. You're looking around and New York's all around you, and you're on this freaking hunk of metal with shishi hors d'oeuvres going by. It was one of the great parties I've been to in this business.
Wow.
And now the GoBots, man, they're I saw Cy Kill on Lancashire Boulevard with a squeegee.
Yeah.
You know, just at the off ramp, you know, he's looking up at a Transformers poster, like, why not me?
Yeah, Scooter's a failed child star. It's sad.
They should have been first.
Yeah.
They weren't.
But you raise an interesting point. It's like back in the day where there was money, and I don't know what ever happened to money. I don't see it anymore.
It disappeared.
Yeah, but I remember in the 90s, there was a lot of money. Like, we were always going to New York for Emmys, and
It was great. Warner's
was amazingly generous. Well, they flew you out there just recently for the Superman thing, right?
Yeah. Home video people still have money.
They still have money.
I remember, these are still a cash crop. That's.
I remember once going out for a toy fair. This was in 97. It was the year that Batman and Robin came out, and there was a huge party, and I went to it with Gene McCurdy, and it was like some mammoth New York building, and everybody was there. Uma Thurman and Schwarzenegger and Clooney, and it was just, you know, amazing, you know, and it was all to celebrate the movie coming out and the toys, you know, the whole toy line and everything. Boy, you know.
Those were the days. You know, there were three networks.
Yeah.
somehow the money was more concentrated.
I know. It's weird. And it's like it all sort of fell away and all the money got spent or wasted or something. You still see it a little bit in things. Like, I guess now people promote a lot of stuff at Comic-Con, and although I have no idea what's coming up this year.
We'll find out.
Yeah. Well, we come down to the end of another one with Alan Burnett. Thank you very much for being a guest for the second week in a row. Where does the time go? And we have to do this again, you know, when Misty's back to liven up the proceeds. So we will do that again soon. So welcome to the wonderful world of podcasts. This is your first podcast, right?
I think so. It's the first podcast I've ever had.
Somebody just recorded his voice and added it somewhere.
I think I've been on another podcast someplace else, but I can't tell you where.
Did you ever do Shokas Radio?
No, I've never done that, but I listened to it. It's great. I think there's a real good service provided there by letting all these people who normally don't get the spotlight get it. And they tell wonderful stories.
Yeah.
That's great.
It's all about the stories.
So tune in next week for more stories.
Yep, we got them.
Thanks a lot, everyone.
Night.
This has been another episode of RadioRashi.com. If you've enjoyed this episode, let us know. You can leave comments and reviews on iTunes or directly on RadioRashi.com. We're also now on social network sites like Twitter and Facebook. Leave us questions or just like us. And don't forget, tell your friends.